Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From 16 West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Glad, as always, to have you along. This week, another development in these hyper-partisan times. On Monday, the executive director of the State Board of Elections was fired. Kim Strack, widely respected for conducting thorough and effective investigations of both Democrats and Republicans since being appointed to her position in 2013, was bounced by the new democratically controlled board. The board praised her before voting to replace her. Should note right off the top, Strack's husband is an attorney who has represented North Carolina Republican legislative leaders when they've been sued in recent years. Now, this action from earlier this week has met considerable criticism, a scathing op-ed in the Charlotte Observer, and some fierce rhetoric from Republicans here at the North Carolina legislature. And there was collateral damage. Moments after Strack was voted out, Josh Lawson tendered his resignation. Lawson is general counsel for the board and has been a key member on some of those investigations I mentioned a moment ago, election fraud and campaign finance violations among them in recent years. Josh Lawson joins us now on the podcast to chat about his week. Hi, Josh.
Good to be here. Hi.
The choice to resign. Tell me about it.
It was a tough choice. I love this job. I have loved every minute of the last 5 years. I've enjoyed being part of a tremendous crew that works incredibly hard, harder than I kind of see in state government more broadly, and have been tremendously grateful for that opportunity. I was also in a protected position. It's a non-political civilian or civil appointment, and I was torn about what the best thing for the state would be, torn about what the best thing for me would be. Ultimately, though, I think it was the right call. I think it was the right time to step away, and I've been committed to the way of approaching this job and the way of our agency approaching elections that we've reflected over the past 5 years. The past 5 years, while I've been there, there have been 9 new elections. We have been opening the hood on a lot of things and trying to demonstrate a commitment to do the hard work necessary to become the new South that we claim. And if the board was wanting to pivot, which it signaled that it was in its actions, but also in the comments that it made during its meeting, I figured that that would be a pivot away from what I had enjoyed about the job.
When you say a pivot away from, I mean, are we talking strictly about replacing the executive director of the board, Kim Strack, or are there other things to this? Is it more nuanced?
When pressed to talk about some of these issues in the public meeting as to why they would pivot now from one director to another, one director who has been part of an era in our agency for 19, coming on 20 years, and who has been a force towards this look under the hood mentality.
Kim Strack.
Kim Strack. To another director who we wish her the best. She has to succeed. We should all be invested in her success. But who came up through the ranks through Gary Bartlett's prior leadership and continues to work for him currently and lives in South Carolina. The hope was that we would be able to have some type of justification that the public would be able to accept as to why the board was doing this. And the justification that was given, at least on the public call, was that there needed to be greater emphasis on election administration than there was on investigation, especially in recent years. And we believed that we were chewing gum and walking at the same time. There are difficulties with county level administration, and much of the administration of elections is done at a county level. But that justification in particular signaled to me that this might be the time that, you know, if we're moving in a particular direction, I may not be part of that future. And I'm happy to have a great future somewhere else. And there's a great team, and I wish them the very, very best. I've recruited almost everybody that I work with on a daily basis, and that you can't trade that in. I mean, they're just incredible and skilled people, and they're going to keep this thing going forward. And I really do wish them the best in that effort, but I believe it was time for me to step aside.
That is, if you're good at hiring people and finding talent, which based
I'm
on that comment,
tremendous at
you're
hiring
good at
people
that,
and
which
finding
is an important
welcome.
Note.
As a taxpayer, you are welcome.
I think there are moments where something happens in your life and you know you need to respond in a certain way, even if that's maybe not the easy thing to do. And then there are other times where you wrestle with it, you weigh it. I mean, there's a pros and cons list, to be cliche here for a moment about it. For you, when you found out that Strack was going, did you know immediately? Were you like, that's it, I'm out of here? Or were there a couple of late nights? Were there a couple of stiff drinks? Was it a long conversation with people that are closest to you? I mean, how did you ultimately come to the decision?
I first of all, kind of put a lot of faith in people and hope that they make a call that's consistent with the way that I see it. But we don't have control over things we don't have control over. And so when thinking through what my response would be in the event that they pivoted in the direction that they did, it was a lot of late nights. For me, that just means not sleeping at all. Talking a lot to my wife, Kat Lawson, who's tremendous at everything, but also at being my wife of 11 years, and we've kind of talked through everything, and important people in my life to try to kind of weigh this out, because there are lots of voices, especially now. You know, Kim and I are the only people with security clearances. We're two of the people who have tried to lead our response to some of these challenges that are so much broader than even any investigation that anyone sees, right? And they're countervailing values, right? Do you stay? Do you stick it out? Do you believe that you will be given the opportunity to continue serving in a way that was going to be productive, or do you not? And for me, I think it was going to be the right time. If I was going to leave at any time before 2020 is done, now's the time, because 8-month departure from now, that would be more crippling to what I think they need to do in order to prep for one of the most significant elections we will ever have, or at least have ever had.
In terms of the process and the logistics, the feasible reason for you to go now as opposed to at the end of this year, I mean, that's logistical chaos from an administrative standpoint if you were to leave later on. Is that a fair way of looking at it?
Or I don't fancy myself that much that it would be chaos in my absence. Okay. However, it would be more difficult on a logistical front. And you know, there were folks who thought, hey, you probably should just try to make that transition work. And I honestly think that the transition will work better without me there. And I think that it'll also be an opportunity for folks like you, others in the press corps, to have to get acquainted with this new director, understanding that it's not necessarily the same dynamic, same set of people who have surrounded this director as opposed to the past ones. So knowing that there's difference, I think, encourages the press pool to do its job, which in my view is critical to our agency's function in a way that's probably unique even within state government. And I thought that stepping down would be most likely to engender some of your better involvement in our agency.
I don't intend to be flippant with saying it's just politics, and we can break that down a little bit. But is this ultimately just politics, Strack being ousted? I mean, this is ultimately because she's either a Republican or she's an unaffiliated, but because of who her husband is, because the governor now has the power back over the board, and as a brief reminder, and I think our listeners are pretty darn smart when it comes to North Carolina politics, but the governor historically for a century's time has had control over the state board of elections. The governor-elect lost that power in late 2016 and has been litigated for the better part of 2 years or 2+ years. So Governor Cooper's board wasn't able effectively to have done this in 2017 or 2018. Cooper won the litigation, won the lawsuit. It's now a board that reflects his party, 3 Democrats, 2 Republicans, and that board voted to bounce Kim Strack, despite, as I noted off the top, at least from my perspective, I haven't been around this scene that long, but she's widely respected. I haven't heard a lot of critiques about her, if any, in the last 5 years. So that's all a little bit of context as I ramble through it, and I come back to, it's all politics, right?
At the point in time we're talking right now, I remain at the board and I'm still their lawyer. So, you know, I'll let their personal justification stand as they made clear in their in their statements. I will say that if what you mean by it's all politics is this is something that should be expected and should be understood to be part of the normal process in our state, the only thing that I would say there is that Kim Strack is only the 3rd director that our state has had since 1965. It is not the case that with every gubernatorial election, there is automatically a change in leadership. During the times that we had, you know, 2 Republican governors where nothing was done to oust
Governor Jim Martin.
Yes, exactly. But from 1965 until 1993, right, that was Alexander Brock, one director that entire time. After that, it was Gary Bartlett who ran things for 20 years until 2013. And so I don't know that if what you mean by it's just politics is this is normal or ought to be. It hasn't been historically normal. It may become normal. But that is not, I don't necessarily think that if you're saying it's a proxy for tradition, it's not traditional.
You mentioned your job is, I mean, you're still in this role, but this role is protected. Should the executive director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections be a protected position where he or she can't succumb to this hyper-partisanship that we're in? I mean, is that feasible, and would you like to see that 10 years down the road or 26 days down the road?
Yeah. And under current case law, the new case law, there are a lot of reasons that the court, state Supreme Court, put in place. Justice Ervin, writing a very lengthy opinion, indicated that he thought that it was so critical for this position to carry the weight of the governor's policy and preference and control, that it was in fact unconstitutional to do something that would curtail that authority. I will say, if you're in this on the 17th?
Yes.
Okay, well, 45 years ago that day, then Senator Ervin opened the Watergate hearings by indicating that it was critical in the democratic tradition of the United States that elections operate outside the control of any one administration, and that the reasons for that were not only a history of us valuing the democratic process as something that can't be commandeered by anyone, but that in segregating out some type of administrative process that ensures that people's votes are counted and counted without any kind of policy sway affecting their counting and casting of votes, that in doing that, we create an atmosphere where people trust democratic outcomes, that they actually trust the outcomes of elections. And I think that that is important, and I think it's important to take seriously that set of values, even if presently the state constitution is being interpreted not to allow directly implementation of those sets of values.
And in this moment, when some of our institutions, if not so many of our institutions, are being challenged and the credibility being chipped away at, I'll look in the mirror. I mean, journalists aren't. I mean, we have fake news and elections. Well, there are fake elections. There are garbage results, real or perceived. How much of that played into your decision to say, I've got to take a stand here. I've got to step down?
I think democracy is worth taking seriously. It is one of those keystone parts of who we are as Americans, because we are not united by religion, less united by cultural background, less and less united by common experiences. We are very different people calling ourselves a capital P people, right? And part of the way, and a major way that we do that, is through participation in this process of democracy, from voting to civic discussion, all of those types of things. And so democracy, to me, is very much worth being taken seriously. But I agree with you that the kind of collateral attacks, often the same attackers that focus their efforts against the press or institutions of law enforcement or in general elections, that we're all facing a common threat. And that threat is exacerbated by a lot of factors. But for me, something like the value in preserving and advancing participation in the franchise, it's one of those really sacred things. It's like faith, hope, and love. The greatest is love. Why? Because you will have faith in people. You will have hope for them if you love them. And if you believe that democracy is worth something, if you think that the vote is important, you're going to then believe in things like the First Amendment, so that we can have informed citizens whenever they're going to vote. You're going to believe in a type of government that is structured a certain way to preserve personal liberty. And so, for me, yeah, it's exceedingly important. And you're absolutely right that the same forces that attack you all attacked us frequently and co-opted. Just as we saw in the Mueller report, they were tweeting things about us that were being reported in various news outlets just to undermine confidence, right?
Your guest on the WUNC Politics Podcast is Josh Lawson. He is still, for two more weeks, the general counsel of the North Carolina State Board of Elections. He offered his resignation this week after his boss, Kim Strack, was ousted by the board. You can follow him on Twitter at Josh_Lawson. Lawson, L-A-W-S-O-N. Part of the letter that you offered up this week reads, quote, "Choices shape democracy, and yours have out..." This letter given to the State Board of Elections that you offered this week, quote, "Choices shape democracy, and yours have outsized effects in our state. This agency serves voters best when it chooses accountability over complacency, people over partisanship, and the future over our past. These serious times require nothing less. As you confront real and growing threats to election security, public trust, and the democratic process," close quote. Largely speaks for itself, but is there anything that you would add to that?
I have been so pleased to serve this state. It has been the joy of my professional life, and I've had great professional experiences. I mean, other than being a ranch hand, my first real professional job was as an editor at the White House. I've got to work at some tremendous places that I've loved every minute of, but this takes the cake. I mean, it's been absolutely a privilege to try to defend democracy during this time, in particular, in this state in particular. I've loved every minute.
Candidly, we would not be chatting if Kim Strack had not been fired this week, your boss. You've worked closely with her for a number of years. We heard a lot of praise about her this week. To the extent you're comfortable and can do so, tell me something about her that we haven't heard. I mean, just pull back the curtain a little bit more on what it was like to work with her. I mean, is she really a bulldog in terms of being an investigator? I mean, she's catch glimpses of her.
Yeah.
I mean bulldog in a positive way.
Yeah, absolutely. All of the praise has been so justified and still understates the type of person that she's been for the state over a period of time when it was exceedingly difficult for her to do so. She has made increasingly good decisions, solid decisions under enormous pressure. It is especially true that in this state you must be aware of the various forces at work and the fallout from every direction that you make a decision. And she has still consistently, over time and with greater and greater effect, made the right call. And that speaks volumes. It is not that she has triangulated her positions between parties. She's set that aside and said, we will navigate what we need to navigate by doing what we do in a transparent way, but we are going to make the right call regardless of the fallout. And it's been a joy to watch her work. I have learned so much. I aspire to have the type of character that she's demonstrated. And I hope to get there. She has done a tremendous job, and the voters will never even know some of the tough calls that she made on their behalf, to their benefit, to the benefit of the system of democratic process. And I hope she feels the love from this week. I hope very much that this remains part of the DNA of our state for quite some time.
There's a tweet pinned to the top of your Twitter feed. It's been there, I think, for now more than 8 months. It reads, "I get it. Democracy is complicated, so I went ahead and printed instructions. You're welcome." And there's a picture of your custom license plate, which reads simply "Vote" in capital letters.
That's right.
How long have you had that plate? And what was the inspiration for getting it?
I was very nerd proud of it. I had been looking for that plate, and it was being used by someone else somewhere in the state.
Okay.
Just about every 3 months, I would check for years. And then, of course, either someone passed away, God rest their soul, or they moved away, which, you know, good riddance, right? We're a great state. I got it, and I was very happy about it. So I didn't want it to be "vote" with an exclamation point or anything else. Just make it a fact of your life. Vote. And so if I cut you off, I'm so sorry, on the road or otherwise.
Oh, yeah. No plans to give up the license plate, right? I mean, new job.
No way. That's mine forever.
That's
mine
forever.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
All right.
You're not the first person to ask, actually.
Special election turnout last month in the third congressional primary was 14.5%. 2016 general election turnout, 68.9%. Almost 69%, 68.98%. Pretty good. Still, there were, I believe, more than 2.1 million registered voters who didn't vote in 2016. Roughly one in three registered voters, right? Almost one in three, who for whatever reason did not go to the polls. If you were tasked with bringing voter turnout to more than 90 or 95% in this state, how would you do it?
First, I'd fix the numbers. There are reasons that they're inflated, and they're good reasons. It's, we have a bias against keeping people on the rolls, and it's federal, and that's a good thing to have. It'd be nice to factor out some of that larger baseline.
But if we have, and you'll know this off the top of your head, we have how many? We have 6.9, 7 million registered voters. How many?
6.7, right, okay. Roughly, right. Yeah.
But you're saying, just for clarification, if there are 6.7 million registered voters in this state right now, half a million? 200,000, 50,000.
Let's go half a million, right?
Okay.
So it's going to change
the registered in the state.
They've moved away. Not everybody lets their old state know. Whatever, but it's a process worth having. And God knows, it's better to have a lower turnout percentage than to have people who aren't on the rolls.
Okay.
So
accuracy issue fixed.
Yeah. How that's my lawyer moment's done.
Fair enough.
So how you would encourage people to participate? I think that one of the better ways that we can do that is by confronting the forces out there that are actively trying to demoralize participation. And by that, I don't mean anything that's necessarily partisan. In fact, partisanship itself is often used to drive participation by people who otherwise would be less engaged. I don't mean that it does so well or in the best interest of the people at large.
That it does.
That's right, but that it does. And what does not is when you are able effectively to convince people that the system is rigged in such a way that their participation and the time that it takes to participate, to research and do it effectively, is just not worth it. So that if you are dropping off your kid at school in the morning and you got to get to work and you're not sure whether you should make that call of 30 minutes, an hour, whatever, right? You're definitely not going to do that if you think that the thing is rigged, that nothing that you're going to do is going to have any efficacy whatsoever. And so I would work to eliminate the barriers there. And on the influence side, that looks like combating the type of erosion of public confidence that comes with these foreign actors interfering and saying that it's rigged. And then on our side, I would work very hard to try to remove the barriers that are systematic, right? Whether that's in the districting process, whether that's in how we talk about districting, that make people believe that the outcomes are determined regardless of their participation, because truly in a democracy, it should not be that way. Whether that's from the Electoral College to districts, there are lots of ways that our system tells that to people, and it should not have to be true.
A couple of quick hitting electoral questions. Expound if you like. Independent redistricting, are you in favor of it? And is there a state or a model that you think would work best here in North Carolina?
And I should say, I can't speak on behalf of any kind of proposals or anything like that. Right. I'm still an employee of the state,
right,
and have certain limitations there. If you're asking just my personal view.
Just you yourself and you.
I think there's a future for independent redistricting models that has not yet fully been realized, but that the way that both data and the law are evolving together, and I think productively, we could see a situation where there were various maps proposed and could be changed by the democratically elected folks, but it would set it up such that deviations from that map would be looked at more closely by the courts. So if a district was drawn a particular way and you wanted to adjust two lines of it, you would have to come up with a justification for why you wanted to adjust that line. So it flips the burden. Instead of plaintiffs go out there and try to figure out what was in our mind and whether or not it was acceptable and constitutional and whether it would pass muster in a court, it flips the burden and says, all right, what was in your mind? Because why are you deviating from what this other process, right, this independent process has produced? So I think that could be a way to evolve the process in a way that would be productive for our state and others, hopefully. That said, in execution, independent redistricting has not always been the answer, and certainly not the panacea that has been sought. Some of the same factors act to affect those districts as act to affect any other collection of people, including elected ones, right? But I do think that there's a future, especially as technologies develop and as we get greater clarity from the courts over the next couple months, both federal and our state courts, about what the standards ought to be when we are differentiating between people based on their party affiliation or political beliefs.
We're going to move through a few with a little bit more tempo, only because I want to be aware and appreciative and respectful
of my
your
lack of
time.
Coffee. Is that
No. We just go hodgepodge here at the end, so we're going to bounce around a little bit. 1 month from today, mid-June, what are you doing?
I'm looking for a job. I'm looking for a job. That's and maybe working on my Leno beard. I'm not sure. We'll see. We'll see.
3 months from today, where are you working?
I'm a lawyer, so I would likely remain a lawyer. I would still work in four people, hopefully the people in some way, but we'll see. We'll see. I'm not trying to be evasive. It's just
you're a lawyer,
I'm being honest.
So you have to write. There you go. Yeah. Favorite podcast, and please do not pander.
Well, this is a funny one for somebody who worked in a Republican White House and then was an aide to a Republican Attorney General. Mm-hmm. Pod Save America is actually, I think it's hilarious. I don't know if it's just that I can identify with some of the things that they kind of self-reference, having worked in D.C. for so long, that right. are just hilarious to me. I do not share the same kind of approach to, or certainly solutions. I say many of the same approaches, actually, and that's why I like it. Is that there's a certain camaraderie, notwithstanding the fact that we would probably reach very different conclusions on the way to fix that problem. But agreeing that the problem exists, agreeing that these pieces should be part of a solution. But it's fun, and I mow my own lawn like a lot of us do. And you got to listen to something, right? So you might as well chuckle.
I had a conversation with somebody yesterday. Hopefully this one doesn't make you too uncomfortable. But we're talking about a political spectrum. And I said, you know, from Bernie Sanders to Rick Santorum. I'm adding that part in now. But I said the political spectrum. Now I'm offering Bernie Sanders to Rick Santorum. I said, you know, where's Josh Lawson? I was like, he's got to, like, if this is the middle, and I'm holding my hand up, you know, right between where Sanders and Santorum would be, like equidistant between them. Josh Lawson is like just to the right of center, maybe? And I asked somebody this question. They go, he might be right on top of center. Where would you put yourself on the political spectrum?
I care about people a lot. I care about preserving their freedoms. I also know that it's not about just freedom from government and interference from government, but it's freedom to pursue things that are important to them. And that means that there's a mix that naturally derives from that position. It means that you can't just put on one set of glasses and say that the only thing that we're going to care about is ensuring that people who have abilities or resources are able to succeed and that a system rewards that. It then also means that you don't see everyone as having no agency in their own lives. And so you want to advance policies and prevent a worldview that values both. And I know that our current political system does not hold those two things in one hand, but it should. And I think it can if we're able to figure out how we can see humanity in each other. Because at the end of the day, good-meaning people just can't see themselves in the other side. They just can't. It could be a generational thing that, you know, my grandma can never see herself in Ocasio-Cortez, right? And it's understandable for lots of reasons that separate them. But at the end of the day, they were both in this country where they have incredible opportunity, where they talk about the country in incredibly different ways. But if we can get past kind of the little totems that we all have to kind of pray to on each side, then I know it's completely Pollyanna-ish and head in the clouds. But you know what? We might be able to just outsmart these guys. And pull something off. And I don't know who's out there saying that yet, but they should be. And I think the voters might be receptive to hearing true things. And that's a risk worth taking, because if they're not receptive to that, well, at least you tried, right?
You work in the George W. Bush White House that's as right. a 20-something, a young yeah, to mid 20-something.
Yeah, I was an editor. I was 20, 21 and 22.
I would imagine you had a number of pinch me moments, but share with us one, if you would.
Sure, pinch me moment. Yeah, sure.
Where were you? Who was it? Why was it a pinch me moment?
I was, like I said, very young. I did not want to pay for parking in D.C. That was crazy. So I got a motorcycle and decided that, notwithstanding the fact that my helmet got stolen, I was not going to prioritize that as a purchasing decision, and subsequently got rear-ended by somebody, went flying, right? Busted out three of my teeth. Yeah, crazy. I've got a big old long scar along my chin still. That's courtesy pavement in northern Northwest
that's
Washington.
Courtesy the son of the you-know-what who hit you.
You're not kidding. You're not kidding. They hit and run. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, man.
Yeah. My then girlfriend came running up being like, oh, my gosh, right? Exactly. But about 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, I saw the president, and he has no reason to talk to you necessarily. Very kind guy, but, you know, has a lot on his mind. There were a couple wars going at the time. And immediately he's like, what happened to you? And I said, well, sir, here's the story. And then he was like, well, I have a mountain bike. I'm like, I know, sir. He's like, I fell off too. I know, sir. He pointed out a scar on his chin. And then he said, mine's cooler than yours. And I said, yes, sir. Yes, right? Sir. Exactly. You're 20, 22. You're talking to the President of the United States. Wow. It's a yes, sir moment. But it is hilarious because you just get these chances. Another motorbiking story. John Ashcroft, former governor, mm-hmm. then senator, then attorney general.
Right. Whose office you worked in?
He left the Justice Department, and I worked as his aide when
okay.
he did.
Okay.
But we used to go out and ride dirt bikes. It's another motorcycling story, at a ranch. And he had cut a path through this whole little area in Virginia. And his wife wouldn't let him go alone. Understandable, right? Be a problem. So I was out there with him. And, you know, we would just start talking about random stuff, but then just stumble upon things like the origination of the Patriot Act and whether or not he'd do it over. You know, those were the types of pinch me moments
right.
That define you a lot whenever you're young. Sure. You're 21, 22 at that time, 23 and 24.
Right.
And you come at this all different and you think, wow, these folks are really just folks. And if they're just folks, you can reason with folks. You can talk to folks. You can be folks. I loved it. I mean, I love those jobs. I've been very, very fortunate. In the vast majority of my yeah. professional career. It's been amazing.
Would he have redone the Patriot Act?
He explained the conclusion that they had drawn that it was inevitable that something like 9/11 or worse was imminent at the time that they proposed it. Turned out to be incorrect. And I loved that he was willing to be retrospective about that, a little bit contemplative about it, and saying, you know what? We were convinced of something that ultimately ended up not being true. We know that he was ousted from the Bush administration when he refused to authorize warrantless wiretaps, even when from his hospital bedside, folks were forcing it on him. Comey tipped off his chief of staff so that they knew that Andy Card's folks and Alberto Gonzalez were mm-hmm. rushing to his hospital bedside to try to force him to do it when he was right. partly sedated. I've been really lucky to see examples of people who have stuck up for what they considered to be right, notwithstanding if the attacks are coming from their own side, which for me is frequent. I think that he was proudest of those types of moments. And I think that it's the case that especially in times where there are decision points that people need to be making, that they're going to look back 10 years, 20 years from now and be proudest of the moments where they did what they thought was right, notwithstanding what the dynamics were at the time. It cost him a lot. He didn't get to be the second term AG. He's a tremendous man, and I still think that he was proud of his decisions.
And you've thought about him a lot in the last 7 days.
I have not thought about him in the last 7 days.
Okay, all right.
I
was thinking based on what you...
It would make narrative sense.
It would.
I'm just being honest. I'm just telling you how it is.
You have 4 degrees or 5?
4.
Okay, that's 3 more than I have. 3 more than I'll ever have. Over, under 1.5... future degrees that you will earn, not counting any kind of ceremony
I've
or
been
honorary
banned.
Degree that you may.
No, I've
you
been completely banned.
By,
oh gosh,
by
yeah.
Your,
my wife
by your
is
partner, by
yeah,
house.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah. And she and she's not like against higher education. She's, you know, Duke Law, big scholarship. You know, incredible. I am banned. I'm banned for life. If there's anything else that I think I need a credential in, that was just a misimpression by myself. I've understood it to be.
Do you think that's going to hold, or could we get like a Pete Rose reinstatement?
I think it's going to hold.
I think it's going to hold. Reinstated yet? So
that's true. That's
What's
true.
More? Okay.
That was hopeful though. I like that.
Favorite small town in North Carolina. I'm really rattling through a lot of these.
You know,
I think two or three, but these have been great. So
Boone doesn't count as a small town, but I think it's hilarious because it feels like it's trying to be.
Okay.
so much to their chagrin. I like Snow Hill. Snow Hill's. It's solid. I couldn't quite probably put into words exactly why it's solid, but it so is.
I'm going to throw myself on the spot. Is Snow Hill in Duplin County?
No, it's in. It's right on the other side of that border, though.
Okay. With Pender.
Yes.
Or, okay.
Yes.
It's exit.
Oh gosh,
I
can't
remember
the
exit.
I don't know the exits.
Or four of.
I use Google for everything.
Right.
I barely know my relatives' phone numbers. Okay. Like it's a problem.
Final one is not from me. It's from the man who I share a wall with, Gary Robertson.
You
came in here, and he said, He said, look at Hollywood coming in. He didn't really say that.
Are you accusing me of like a Comey situation? Like that's just, okay, well, if you are, Mueller is, Kim Strack is North Carolina's Mueller in that case, which is far classier than if you're accusing me of being the Comey, but notwithstanding.
See, the problem here, I'm a BSer, and now you're just going to get me to, this is not what I was about to ask you. If you could have a steak dinner tonight with Mueller or Comey, who are you sitting down with?
Mueller. Because I'm totally going to get Comey's, like, everywhere, right? I've read the Mueller report okay. 1.5 times, including footnotes. I've read Comey's book, Comey is far more likely to volunteer sure. What would be much harder to get. So,
fair enough.
You know, and that explains my early dating career and resulting marriage. And so,
yeah. Last question out of me comes from Gary Robertson, Associated Press State House reporter, who I share a wall with here in the basement of the legislature. He said, make sure you ask Josh. He said this to you just out here half an hour ago.
Yeah.
He said, you know, what kind of brushes has he had with Hollywood? so I haven't formulated a question or anything, but you are originally from California.
I'm all over, man. My dad, I list the kind of places that I've lived as a kid, and people ask if I was military, and I'm like, it's far worse. He was a minister. We lived everywhere, but from about 13 through college, and then worked for a year, we were in California. That's right.
Any actors or actresses that ever came into your father's congregation?
Congregation, no. Elevator, yes. Okay. Dustin Hoffman walked in once, made no eye contact. I actually noticed it was him because of his hair. You know, like there's Hollywood like people, they have like, exactly. But like in a way that on camera looks like a normal person, but all these Hollywood people, it's like when standing among us mere mortals, right? Their contrast level is high, like crazy. Right. Like girl next door, guy next door in whatever movie, they're 10 times better looking than anyone you've ever seen before. But with him, hair, and the reason I noticed is because the top of his head was below my shoulder.
Right.
And I was like, who has hair like that, but is also small? Venn diagram. Very, very narrow there. You know, you have him and a couple others, but really it was a Hoffman moment. He left. I didn't say a thing, but that was my minute of Hoffman.
I've run out of tape. I've run out of questions.
I've run out of words because I ran out of coffee long ago. Yeah.
Josh Lawson, still for another couple of weeks, general counsel at the North Carolina State Board of Elections. He resigned this week out of protest after the executive director of that board, Kim Strack, was fired by the new democratically controlled board. He talked about it here with us, as well as a litany of other things. Josh, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thanks for indulging my free flow.
Always a treat to have you along listening to the WUNC Politics podcast. You can download it wherever it is. You get that on-demand listening, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. Make sure that you catch up with what else is happening in the world of North Carolina politics. You can do that at our website, WUNC.org. Check out our weekly conversation with Becky Gray of the Conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch. For Josh Lawson, I'm Jeff Tiberi. We'll talk to you again soon.